And now I would like to introduce our real speaker, Kelly from Laguna Niguel.
I'm Kelly. I'm an alcoholic. And I want to say thank you so much to Rhonda for a great 10-minute talk. You know, whenever if I'm ever asked to speak at a conference or whatever or in a meeting, I always identify one woman that I wish I could have gotten drunk with. And she was it. And I am one boring, suicidal, limp, alcoholic mess. I'm not a crash and burn. I don't have an exciting, you know, I'm just, watching me drink is like watching the paint dry. And if you're like that and you're here, then welcome. You know, I mean, it's not really what it did to you or how much you drank. It's what it did for you. And whenever I hear a story like Rhonda's and that of my sister Ann Wood in the back, I always think I wish I would have, in some sense, I wish I would have drank, you know, 1 year more so that I could have had just that experience of, you know, hell and back. I had enough of a hell that got me in here. But I always think when I hear that kind of a story, when I saw that Tom Cruise movie, War of the Worlds, when they had those gigantic tripod robots, you know, it's just like boom, boom, boom. We would have gone from trailer park to trailer park, ex-husbands in our wake, you know. There would have been nothing left, and that would have been the greatest, best last year of my drinking. And there's something about a redhead alcoholic woman that you just cannot, it's just, you know, you'll have a good time. So, oh, God. So I want to say thank you for a great 10-minute talk. I also want to say thank you so very much to Craig for his remarkable hospitality and to Tom for the coffee this morning. I've only had coffee and sugar this morning, so it'll be a talk. You won't forget because it'll be fast. I want to say thank you to Marcus, wherever Marcus is. There he is. He carried my suitcase about 8,000 miles yesterday, and what a, you know, 11 months sober, he really exemplifies service in this program because he was there and he was on time and he had a good attitude and he was just, if you don't know who he is, just look for the guy that looks like Schwarzenegger now. So, what a nice gentleman. I want to say thank you so much to Jerome last night for a remarkable talk. What an incredible message he had. I love people who don't look like their story, and he doesn't. He's just he's an example of what Alcoholics Anonymous can do, and it's just been a remarkable, incredible experience. You know, the few hours that I've been here, we have a beautiful room. I have this incredible basket of goodies that I can always tell when a conference when it's going very smooth on the front end, how much work goes on the back end. And at the dinner last night, there were probably, it seemed like 600 people who stood up and had a commitment in this committee. And it just runs remarkably well. We have this incredible basket of stuff in our room. And I'm a person of details. We have good alcoholic chocolate in that basket. None of this, you know, you do that and a cup of coffee and you will feel like you are someone in this world. So, anyway, I want to say welcome to you if you're new, and I'm glad that you're here. I'm so impressed with everything that is just, you know, the way that it has come off so remarkably well. It's real love for Alcoholics Anonymous, and thank you to Tom for the coffee this morning. I got sober September 26, 1984. My home group is the Pacific Group, and my sponsor is Millie Greenberg. And I always start by talking about my first resentment. My first resentment is that I grew up in Southgate, California, and I hate that place. I can't stand it now. I couldn't stand it then. I never wanted to be who I was. I never wanted to be blue collar. I never wanted to be middle class. I never wanted to live in Southgate. I never wanted to I just was so ashamed of who I was. And I always wanted to be tall and blonde and tan and straight white teeth living in Newport Beach, California. I wanted to be one of those women that I always saw that I never could be. I have today some of those things in my life. I just put everything on a credit card. So If you don't come from it, just finance it, and they'll never know. So anyway, I grow up with this feeling inside of me that I couldn't really ever articulate, but the best that I can articulate it is that it felt like a broken sewer line inside of me, and whenever you looked at me, you could smell the stench. There was just something hideously wrong, and I couldn't figure out what it was. I knew that I didn't belong. I knew that I didn't fit in. I knew that there was something terribly wrong, that there was some kind of emptiness, some kind of abyss inside of me. Nothing ever filled it up. And I just walked around in this kind of, you know, dark shroud of being ashamed of who I am and ashamed of my family and not knowing what to do about it. And I took my first drink when I was 12 years old, and I was absolutely, completely home. I don't relate to anybody who, for whatever reason, articulates this kind of story of drinking where I got drunk, I threw up, I hated the way that it tasted. I love everything about alcohol. I love the way that it tastes. It doesn't matter what it is. I love the way that it sounds when it hits the ice. I love the way that it feels going down. I love that initial just incredible hum and buzz that you get if you're an alcoholic of my type whenever you drink. It fills every crevice inside of me in the way that nothing else can, unless and until I come to a program of recovery that also today is filling every single crevice and empty place inside of me. I never thought that that was possible, but I'm here to tell you, if you're new, that we have a program in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you stick around, you'll hear every kind of, I don't know what, in meetings about what our program is. My experience, and my experience only, is that we have a program. It's in between the two, it's in between the hardcovers of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's in between pages 1 and 164 in our Big Book. And it's in our 12 steps and our 12 traditions. That's where I found the answer and the solution and the program of recovery that has given me a remarkable, remarkable life. And so I'm in Southgate, and I can't stand myself, and I get my first drink in me when I'm 12, and I absolutely love it. And some things happened in my childhood that, I came from an interesting family. There were 8 marriages between my two parents. And there were kind of the white-collar drinkers and the blue-collar drinkers. And the blue-collar drinkers were in Southgate, and the white-collar drinkers was really when my father left. He had a pretty interesting life. He had a sports car dealership in La Cañada, and he raced sport cars all over the world. He raced Lotus Elan and MG and so forth, and he was this dirt-poor kid from Glendale. And as soon as he could leave and get his hands on something fast, be it a woman or a Manhattan or, a race car, he did it to the absolute ultimate. So I really wanted what he had. When he drank, his broken sewer line went away, and he turned into Hugh Hefner. And I knew that was the kind of drinking that I wanted. It was always elegant, and it was always glamorous, and it always transformed the people around me, and I wanted to be transformed. I didn't want you to see who I really was. So when I was 15 years old, my mom died of cancer. She died pretty rapidly. Back then, it was 35 years ago. It was, they didn't have hospice, or they didn't have a lot of the drugs that they have now. So she died very quickly, and as soon as she died, I began to drink every day. I don't blame my alcoholism on that event, but that's just what happened. So in high school, I hooked up with my husband-to-be. He also had a broken sewer line in him. And we decided that we were both very ashamed, frightened kids, and we didn't want to be from where we were from. And so we decided that we were going to go make something of ourselves. And so we decided to leave Southgate after high school. We got married, and we blew that pop stand. We moved to the booming metropolis of Long Beach. And he decided to become a marine biologist. He decided to work on his PhD in marine biology. So he set about his schoolwork and went to school for, it seemed like, 1,000 years. And I began to work. And eventually, this is in my early 20s. And, the drinking worked. Alcohol worked. I never really had, I don't have, as I say, I don't have big arrests, or I don't know, no extortions, I never woke up with 10 Marines. I've never been a rock ho. I am, as I say, a very suicidal, morose drunk. And the way that I like to drink is I drink alone. I drink alone because I know the way, when I drink in public, you will notice the way that I drink, and I do not want you to see it. Also, I know that if I drink with you, you'll want some, and that's not going to happen. So I love to, the way that I like to drink and the way that I started drinking when, you know, I got married and we moved to Long Beach and I was in my early 20s is I close the door, I have a fifth of Jack Daniels and a pack of cigarettes and I listen to depressing, dead, drug addict music. And the Doors, anything, you know, anything that's really, I'm not a party girl or a disco queen. I don't like people. There are two things that I cannot stand in this world that I probably should get out of the way. I can't stand reality and I hate people. So when I drink, they make those two things, alcohol makes those two things tolerable. So I love to drink alone, and I love to drink in the dark, and I love to drink. I just enter this fantasy world. And if you're an alcoholic of my type and you're born into, you know, whatever environment you can't stand, I can't wait to get in that dark, isolated, locked-up room with my fifth of Canadian Mist or Jack Daniels or whatever, something brown from Canada, you know, that I can get my hands on. And just be in my world. I mean, that's what alcohol did for me, is it gave me a world. And I hate reality. I hate bills and trash and insurance and tying my shoes and going to work. I hate everything about normal living. What I love is in being and living in this fantasy world of my own making. And so when I drank, that's where I could go. So that's how I drank in the beginning. We moved to Seattle. The race was on. He started his program in marine biology at University of Washington. And when I moved to Seattle, I was able to lie my way into a career that I wanted to do my whole entire life. From the very beginning of my existence, I really wanted to be a newspaper reporter. So that's what I did, is I had no degree in journalism, but if you're a good alcoholic like me, you don't need one because, after all, they're dealing with you. And so I went door to door, and I knocked on newspaper doors, and I, you know, basically said, hire me, I need to be a reporter, hire me, I need to be a reporter. You know, I mean, I just really lied and tap-danced my way into it. And finally, somebody was idiot enough to hire me, and they said, if you, you know, write three stories and you do well, then we'll, you know, we'll get you a job as a reporter. So now I'm a reporter. I'm in my early 20s. I am lying. They think that I know what I'm doing. I don't. I'm fueled by alcohol, and alcohol is my fuel. I absolutely love being wiped out drunk, and especially if I have to lie to do what I'm doing. And you know, I had that was the beginning of my, you know, of my downfall. You never know when, you know, when that's going to start or when, you know, where it's going to lead you if you're a real alcoholic. In fact, I don't think that you have any control over that, as was said in chapter 3 just now. I had no idea that when I took my first drink, when it was on in my 20s, that feeling, that elation was a feeling that was to keep me in bondage for the next 18 years. So now I'm in my early 20s, and I'm lying, and I'm tap dancing, and they don't know, and I don't want them to know, and I'm watching the 6 o'clock news to find out how to do my job. Instead of just, you know, surrendering and going to school and taking the classes like anybody else, you know, I won't do that because I am on the fast track of life, and I don't want people to know where I came from, so the whole thing is a ruse. So anyway, at this point, you know, I'm in my mid-20s, and my alcoholism is progressing, and there's starting to be, you know, some violence, a little bit of violence in my marriage, and I'm starting to show up drunk, and I'm starting to get into trouble in my job. And the way that I get into trouble in my job is this, is I began to write stories about people. And it's not that, you know, when I'm writing something and, you know, I'm taking notes, whatever, you know, it's not that what you're saying to me I don't get right. It's when I sit down and I write the story. I don't write what you said. I write what you could have said if you were more interesting. So that's the kind of reporting that I did. And your attorney would call me the next day and say, what you said was just as interesting as it was, and it didn't need to be, you know, novelized or anything. So I was, like, in trouble, and now I'm in trouble, and now I'm drinking more. And it's a dog chasing his own tail, and I don't know how to get out of it. And, you know, alcohol was never a problem for me. It was always my solution. It was everything in the world to me. It was my higher power and my God and my lover and my husband. It was the first power greater than myself that I had ever known. And so I always went to it, and it was working well. And if you're an alcoholic of my type, you know, you probably remember the point at which it was not a problem. In fact, I always prided myself on the way that I drank, because I could drink anybody that I knew under the table. I had this kind of machismo about the way that I drank, and it was my strength. It gave me a power that I didn't have when I was sober. The problem was when I was sober and when I wasn't drinking. Sobriety was the problem. Drinking was the answer. And so in my normal state, I am drunk, and that's my most comfortable state, until I come to Alcoholics Anonymous and realize that there are 12 steps and 12 traditions that give me that feeling of peace and comfort, and then I don't need alcohol. Alcoholics Anonymous, if you're new, will eventually replace that feeling if you work these 12 steps, if you take these 12 steps as they're laid out in the big book. So anyhow, I'm drinking and getting in trouble, and the attorneys are calling, and the publisher is getting mad, and I don't know what the hell is happening, but I'm just drinking more. You know, Jack Daniels and Canadian Mists are ever more my best friend, and most of my drinking was done in Seattle, and Seattle is a great drinking town. It was back then in 78. It was not a Fern Bar at that time, or, you know, a yuppie palace. It was just a great hard scrabble drinking place, and it's depressing. It's my heaven. It's depressing, and it's cold, and it's dark, and you have to stay inside, and it's a wonderful place to be able to be drunk. So I did. Anyway, I cut to the chase pretty quickly about how I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was in my office one day, and a woman came in the door. And she, we started talking, and she was dropping off a press release, and she broke her anonymity to me. And she told me that she was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember asking her about 10,000 questions about what it felt like to be a real alcoholic, because I had never seen one. And I had a cartoon in my head about what an alcoholic was, you know, that they lived at the railroad tracks, that they, you know, wore a soiled raincoat, that they drank Mad Dog. I mean, you know, nothing that I believed that I was. I didn't think that you could be an alcoholic and hold a job, or that, you know, I mean, to that point, I wasn't an alcoholic. I mean, I was a deep-feeling, profoundly wounded, artistic Jack Daniels drinker. And the more that I drank, the more it fueled that incredible creativity that I knew was just right around the corner, that if I just kept, you know, writing and misquoting people, that, you know, I would get there eventually. So anyway, she began to tell me about what it was like, what it felt like to be a real alcoholic. And I didn't identify with anything at all that she had to say. But the wheels began to turn, and this was the early 80s. I got sober in 84. And in the early 80s, the media was really on fire with doing everything in the world alcoholism. You know, Betty Ford had just identified herself, and, you know, they were doing kid alcoholics and dog alcoholics and, you know, men and women and transvestite alcoholics, and they were doing everything in the world. Everybody was an alcoholic in 1983, and if you wanted to really go someplace, you know, you did your story about whatever alcoholic you could find. And I thought, here's my alcoholic, you know. So I began to ask her all these questions, and she said, you seem to be very interested in this. Why don't you do a story about alcoholism? And I thought that would be remarkably socially aware of me. So I said, I would love to, and can you find some really bad alcoholics for me? And she said, yes. You just come to my home group, and I'll introduce you to a whole bunch of them. And I said, great. And, you know, the wheels began turning, and I thought, this is my, you know, by this time I was too big for my britches in this newspaper job, and I wanted to be, you know, on the East Coast where all the real newspapers were. And this was my ticket to stardom. So I was going to, you know, I was a good, grandiose alcoholic. I wasn't going to do just one story. I was going to do a five-part series. And I decided to do a five-part series. One part would be on public policy toward alcoholism. I'd do one on women alcoholics. I'd do one on, probably should throw that thing, Alcoholics Anonymous, that 12-step help group, I think it's called AA. You know, I'll do that, and I'll do, you know, I'll interview maybe some famous alcoholics, and then that is my ticket to stardom. I'll be at the New York Times in a minute. And so I was like pumped. It was like great. I went home, I, you know, got drunk, had a fifth, you know, listened to depressing drug addict music and, you know, outlined my story. So I thought if you're going to do a story, I thought I would start with Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're going to do an expose, I decided that I would do an expose on Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're going to be and do that, then probably the best thing to do, I thought, to infiltrate AA would be to go to several meetings undercover as an alcoholic. So that's how I got to my first meeting of AA's. I went undercover as an alcoholic. And so if you're living in Seattle, there's usually somebody here in a crowd this big. I called Central Office in Seattle, and I happened to identify myself, and I said, you know, I'm going to do a story on AA, and I would like to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and what do you suggest? And they said, we think you should go to the Fremont Fellowship. Right. Yeah, there's usually a Fremonster in a group this big. And the Fremont Fellowship is a remarkable howl at the moon meeting. If you're ever in Seattle, it's still there. I think it's been around 40 years. They even have a fight song, the Fremont fight song. It's just, it's like an AA meeting on really bad steroids. And, but it is remarkable, and I would never, you know, I would never disrespect the Fremont Fellowship because it saved my life, and it's still saving lives, as a matter of fact. So anyway, I went to the Fremont Fellowship, and I walked in this place. I could not believe what I saw. I thought I would sort of dress like a career woman who was hitting the skids and just hitting her bottom, and then I would, you know, I would sort of infiltrate and be undercover. And so I went into this meeting of AA at the Fremont Fellowship, and it was the mid-80s, and everybody in Seattle wanted to look like Anne and Nancy Wilson of Heart, and so it was like gigantic shoulder pads and big hoop earrings and big hair, big permed hair, and I had like this, you know, hot pink, you know, reporter outfit that I wore, and you know, the little high heels and everything. And I walked in the Fremont Fellowship, and it's like 5,000 angry, frightening Hell's Angels, you know, just lined up against the wall. And I took a seat, and you could smoke in meetings back then, so it was like this bank of smoke. And in some of the old clubs, they still have those, you know, those gigantic, huge poster size, like they're 10 by 10 foot of Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob, and these things were like yellowed and spit wads and, you know, graffiti, and somebody put their, you know, cigarette butts out on them. And I kept on thinking, if anybody here has seen the film Reefer Madness, I kept on thinking, I don't know who these two guys are, but they look like the judge at the end of Reefer Madness. And I took a seat, and I heard these stories that I could not believe what I was hearing. I mean, it was like, I just got sprung from San Quentin, and I, you know, in a blackout, killed my old lady last night, and I'm ready for a relationship. And anybody want to have coffee after the meeting? And you know, I just got out of detox, and anybody got a bandage for my, you know, for my track marks? And I was in the back of the room. I sat in the back of the room, and I was white as a sheet. I was like, I have absolutely no identification with these idiots, but I am, they are going to eat this with a knife and a fork back at the office. I have found my ticket. So I sat back there white as a sheet, you know, taking notes, and I just said, I've arrived, you know. I didn't know, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous. It was, you know, I have had this twice in AA. I didn't know what was here. The first time I didn't know that I was an alcoholic when I walked into the Fremont Fellowship. The second time I was to have that revelation was many years later in AA sober. But anyway, I didn't know what was here, and I heard these stories, and I began writing it all down. And I take a little commercial break here for the 11th tradition whenever I tell this story, because we have a set of traditions in Alcoholics Anonymous, and if you're new or not so new, it's important to know those traditions, because in writing down this, your stories, here's what I did, is I wrote down your stories, I used your name, and the next day they were in the newspaper. Yeah. We have an 11th tradition in Alcoholics Anonymous that says we are anonymous at the level of press, radio, and films. I didn't know that. I don't know what will take you out. I don't know what will take me out. But I don't know who I harmed as a result of breaking their anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. But when I called Central Office, if they didn't know about the 11th tradition, they certainly didn't tell me about it. If they knew about it, they didn't tell me about it. And they could have said, perhaps if they had known, you know, please go to an open meeting. We don't use people's names. You know, be anonymous. You know, we'll set you up with someone to talk about Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, that didn't happen, and I didn't know about it certainly. So, these traditions are extremely important for us to know and to observe, because what they do is they protect our fellowships against people like me, who either know better and do it anyway, or don't know better and do it. So anyway, I walked out of that meeting shaking my head going, I am so grateful I'm not an alcoholic. I'm so grateful. But what I am and what will fuel this story is a fifth of Jack Daniels in my dark room. And I'll touch that, you know, artistic, profound place in me, and I'll be able to write this five-part series. Well, I wrote this five-part series and got an avalanche of hate mail from AA. And you know, my drinking got worse in that next year. I'll cut to the chase here. I had a horrible spiral in my marriage, and you know, I just got suicidal, and I wanted to walk in front of city buses, and I didn't know what the problem was. You know, the solution and the answer, well, was always alcohol. But you know, that fifth of Canadian mist, that, you know, my 18 highballs a night wasn't working, it seemed, anymore. So I went to a marriage counselor, and the marriage counselor, in so many words, said, I think that you're an alcoholic. I think you need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was shocked. I could not believe she would call me an alcoholic. Alcoholics don't look like me. They don't act like me. I'd never, you know, I don't have any tattoos. Nothing's pierced. I'd never, you know. But there I was, and I've been sober since that day. I've been sober since she leveled the boom on me. And I didn't know where to go, so I went right back to the Fremont Fellowship, and that became my home group. And those people were remarkable. They knew how to take care of their newcomers. And I got sober my first year in the Fremont Fellowship in Seattle. I would love to tell you that I surrendered when I came into AA. And if you're new, I hope that you are surrendered. I hope that you're surrendered enough to do the following things: to get a sponsor, to get a home group, to be in the middle of AA, to get commitments, to read our big book, and to take the steps exactly as they're laid out, just the black parts of the big book. Take the steps as they're laid out in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and do what we do around here. And that was not what I was in 1984. In 1984... in Seattle, I don't know what was going on here, but what was going on there was a big movement that seemed to just sweep through the fellowship. And it had nothing to do with what was in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It had to do with other 12-step programs. It had to do with finding your guru. It had to do with naming the animals on your inner totem. It had to do with finding your inner child. It had to do with nurturing your inner child. It had to do with getting a teddy bear for your inner child. It had to do with finding the right therapist for your inner child. It had to do with everything except taking your own inventory. Now, in deference to our 10th tradition, if that's what you're doing today, if that's the program of recovery that works for you, I am not here to denounce any of that. If you're sober and you're happy and this is what your sponsor is having you do, your sobriety is not my business. I'm here to tell you what got me sober and what keeps me sober today. So anyway, this movement that came through Alcoholics Anonymous in 1984, I absolutely embraced, because any solution that doesn't encourage me to take my own inventory, that encourages me to blame you or the past for what happened, believe me, I will take to the bank. And so what happened in 84 is I found all the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I found the other crystal tofu healing goddesses. And we formed a coven, and we worked on the wounds that, you know, were inflicted on us. And we did everything in the world that I don't do today. I mean, we showed up late, we left early. I did this remarkably and was able to stay physically sober for 10 years. And that's the program of recovery that I worked. And excuse me, I don't know if there were hardcore, you know, long-timers in any of the meetings that I went to back then, because I couldn't stand those big book thumpers. I couldn't stand those, you know, those step Nazis. I couldn't stand any of those people, and I didn't want anything that they wanted. Without alcohol in me, I'm now looking, without alcohol in me or any program or steps, I am now looking for anything outside of myself to fill that void. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, what I did in my first 10 years of recovery is I worked that program of new boyfriend strength and hope. And I was looking for him, and I was looking for the best way that I could find him. And I was also, you know, I had worked the first half of the first step, which is I'm powerless over alcohol. And I had never come to the second half of the first step, which is I'm also powerless over everything else. And if that is the case, then there are 11 other steps that I must take in order to know what is here, the second revelation in my life about what's here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't do that because I wasn't interested in it, because I felt that, you know, now that I'm sober, that's all I need to do is I need to be physically sober, I need to show up at meetings, and I need to find him. So that's what I did. And I ran with these people, and I found him. I met and married my husband Steve in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we came together on AA campus. You know, we both decided at the same time that we were too well and too graduated for AA. And together, we believe that these 12 steps and these 12 traditions, they're fine for you garden variety drunks, but we have a very deep and profound wound inside, and that it takes a very sophisticated, expensive solution to go correct that wound. And so it's fine for you garden variety drunks, but it's a far too pedestrian solution for someone as exotically wounded as we are. So we became the well couple in Alcoholics Anonymous, in Seattle Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're, you know, your new, you know, your home group probably has one where, you know, we show up and we give you our brilliance and then we leave early. And then one day when you're as evolved as we are, you know, you'll get it too. And all along, you know, at this point, you know, first 5 years of sobriety, I am starting to have secrets. And I am starting to have a double life. And I can't figure that out. It's like things begin to happen. And I start getting angry because I feel that I'm in the middle of AA. I'm going to meetings. What began to happen for me is that I started to get, over the years, into big-time legal trouble. I started to get into big-time financial trouble. I started to get into huge financial difficulties. I began to look to other things outside of Alcoholics Anonymous as my solution and my program of recovery. I went back to school. I decided to stop lying on my resume. We moved to the Bay Area. I went to San Francisco State. I got a degree in international relations, you know, school became my higher power. I decided to, you know, work ever more on that wounded inner child. We went to some very expensive, we spent thousands of dollars on therapy together. We did, you know, non-dominant handwriting and, you know, aggressive. We did corrective parenting. At one point, sometimes I tell this story, Steve was into Chinese herbs at that time. And I came home one day and he had a saucepan on the stove. He was boiling a deer antler. And he was going to drink that, and that was his third step. And that was how far gone we were. You know, I mean, starting to look at these things outside of yourself that have nothing to do with, you know, fixing your alcohol, with, you know, the program of recovery that you're hearing this weekend. So we did that, and we moved to the Bay Area, and we, you know, we got well there, and, you know, more therapy and so forth. And my secrets and my double life sober started to get worse and worse, and I couldn't believe some of the things that were happening to me. But I kept on going to AA, and I kept on working on my AA sound good and my AA look good. Now I have him. We have a house. You know, he's a career guy. Now I have a career. You know, we got it made. I mean, we're just, we're golden. and we're evolved. So this is what happened to me. And during these 10 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, working this program of recovery, you know, putting my spin on it, on everything, you know, I had a sponsor during these years, and I worked the steps. I just had a sponsor that never got me into the big book, that never had me have a commitment, that never got me into the steps, that never got me into the traditions, that never had me surrender and have respect for Alcoholics Anonymous by showing up early, leaving late, doing the grunt work in AA. I never had a sponsor that did that, that suggested that. I chose my sponsors for their hair and what it said on the business card. And I also worked the steps, you know, during these years, but I just did it all myself. I did an inventory, but my inventory was kind of like a therapy inventory where it listed everything, all of the things that you did toward me, my sexual abuse, my, you know, my molestation, my the 8 marriages, you know, my father chasing skirts, my, you know, my mom dying. I mean, it was all, see, every time that I went to someone and I wrote a check and I told them my problems, the response normally was that, you know, you're not responsible for this. All those checks that you bounce, all those failed relationships, all the trouble that you're in at work, it's what was done to you. Now, I'm not here to badmouth therapy because a therapist got me into AA. They were trained people. They were concerned. They were professional. But all of that did not affect my alcoholism. There's only one thing in my experience that affects my alcoholism, and that's the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. So we're in this place, and my life is getting worse, and I'm working the steps my own way. I did do amends. I just did amends in my own way, and the way that I do amends when I don't have a program is I basically would call people, and I would say, you know, I'm Kelly. You probably remember me. We worked together years ago. I did this thing, and if you think about it long and hard enough, you started it. So you think about that. And those were my direct amends. And, you know, when it's said around here that when an alcoholic is in a dry drunk, that they begin to work the 12 steps in reverse. And that's exactly what happened to me right around year, you know, 10, is that, you know, working our 12 steps in reverse, and in the 12th step, you know, I stopped working with others. By some miracle, I had sponsees at this time, and I had to let them go because I now got a job in Silicon Valley, and I was making a little bit of money, and I was on. You know, AA was not important enough to go to or to be associated with. I was too busy, and there were too many demands, and I had to pay attention to my job, and I wanted money, property, and prestige. And why I wanted it was because there's nothing in here. There's not a God in here. There's not a program in here. I married him, and, you know, he's a remarkable man and a remarkable husband, and I adore him, but he couldn't do it. And now I have a career and I have a degree, and that's not doing it. So I've got to eliminate everything that is taking me away from now my solution. And so those sponsees had to be fired, and they had to go. In working the 12 steps in reverse in step 11, I gave up my God and prayer and meditation because he was not giving me what I needed. And so I had to find some other kind of, you know, feminist God, or, you know, whatever kind of God I could find, goddess, hopefully. And I had to adopt that. So I let go of God and prayer and meditation. In that 9th step, you know, I went and found all the people who owed me amends. And working the steps backward, you know, I got to step 6 and 7, and nothing was ever worse, drunk or sober, than when I worked the steps back to steps 6 and 7, because I came to this belief and to this realization and this insanity that said in my head, exactly what Jerome said last night, there's an inner sponsor in your head, and there's an inner drink in your head too, which had started to come back. And it said to me, Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't work, and they're lying to you, and it is taking away your power, and what you need to do now is go get your power back. And I don't know how you go get your power, but the first thing I start to think about is the last thing that gave me power in this world, and that was 87 belts of Jack Daniels. And I was on my way. You know, Clancy says you're either on your way out of Alcoholics Anonymous or on your way in. You are either on your way to your next drink or away from your last drink. And the interesting thing, the cunning, baffling, powerful part of alcoholism is that I can't see that. I can't see when I'm doing that. You can see it. You can see it in people in your home group. You can see it in people around you, but you can't see it in yourself. I didn't know that I was on my way to my next drink, but you saw it. And I don't want you to see me doing that. And so if you're like me and you're a good alcoholic on your way out of Alcoholics Anonymous, what you do is you stop going to meetings because you don't want to get the look. I'm starting to get the broken sewer line look again from people sober this time because it's back. Now it's back and I don't have anywhere to go. Except there's a drink in my head still. Back years and years back, I remember what takes away the big hurt. I remember what filled that hole. I remember everything that warm feeling of Jack Daniels and Canadian Club does for me. And it wasn't a conscious thought, but it was there. And, life got worse. All of my yets that never happened drinking started to show up sober, and I could not get it. And the first thing I blamed was Alcoholics Anonymous, because obviously it doesn't work. I'm going to meetings. But I can't stop failing. I can't stop having a bad marriage. I can't stop having financial problems, and I don't get it. The only constant in my life seems to be AA, and that has got to go because it's not working, and those people are lying. Keep coming back, it works. No, it doesn't. And the reason that it wasn't working was because I never worked it. So what happened for me was one day I was parked outside downtown Oakland. I had a job at the Oakland Tribune. And I remember I was right outside the Oakland Tribune building, and I was parked. It's a really bad neighborhood, and I parked outside. And I remember seeing all these really low-bottom liquor stores and bars that are all around that Oakland Tribune tower. And I was going to go into my office and see somebody, and I was just parked there for the longest time. And I remember looking at these liquor stores going, I am ready. I know who my best friend is, and I miss it, and I'm ready to go back because I'm uncomfortable. You know, it's that you get when you're in a dry drunk and you haven't had a drink for a long time, and you have to have one. And so I knew that I was 3 hours away from a drink. And for whatever reason, I was about ready to get out of the car, go buy a fifth, and just get it over with. Just do it and get it over with. And for some reason, I didn't drink. For some reason, there was a presence in the car that day. And I remember it just felt like, kind of like this big strong hand that was just grabbing my hand, and it just, you know, it said, let's go. And so the car seemed to start itself, and I drove back to was toward the end of the day. I drove back to my house in the Oakland Hills. I sat there. The phone rang, and the phone on the phone was my friend Eric Wong, our friend Eric, and he said, you haven't been to a meeting for a long time. Would you like to go to a meeting? And I said, sure, why not? You know, and I went to this meeting on Wednesday night in Berkeley called the Wild Bunch. And at that meeting, I'm glad that at most of the meetings that we go to, they read chapter 5, because there's a very important line in that chapter that says we stood at the turning point. And when I was willing enough to go to that meeting, it seemed like it was going to be my last meeting before I picked up a drink, I saw this woman speak. And this woman was an attraction in AA. I had never seen this kind of animal in AA before. She was no BS. She talked about the steps. She talked about God. She talked about the big book. She talked about being happy in AA and being happy sober. And I could not believe what I was hearing. I had never heard this kind of thing in AA before, because when you run with the look good, sound good people, you won't hear that message. You'll hear our enlightenment, and you'll hear our insight, strength, and hope, you know, but you're probably not going to hear the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for the first time, it seemed, in 12 years, that's what I heard. So I went to her after the meeting, and I asked her to be my sponsor. And she said, yes, I'm happy to do that. This is what we're going to do. The first thing that we'll do is we're going to meet once a week. We're going to go through this thing. It's been around the program a long time. It's blue. It's called the Big Book. And what we're going to do is I'm going to read a page and you're going to read a page, and we're not going to stop until we get through the first 164 pages. And when there's direction in that book, you're going to take that direction. She said that Alcoholics Anonymous is a lot of things, but one thing it is not is it is not negotiable. So are you willing to go to any lengths? And it was either that or drink or, you know, put a gun in my mouth, and I said yes. So I met with her once a week at Java Central in Alameda, a very unglamorous place to get sober. And we went through the big book page by page, and when there was direction in that book, I took that direction. And I began to do things that I had never done before, that I had never considered doing. You know, the first thing we did is we did... two things jumped out at me when I began to read the big book, and one was from chapter 2, that we have found a common solution. And see, the problem is you can't find a common solution unless and until you're a common drunk. I had to give up being an alcoholic and I had to give up being the wounded, you know, I had to give up the wounded inner child thing. Not that there's anything wrong with it, but for me, I had to give that up. I had to give up what happened to me in the past. And having that define, you know, my entire sobriety, I had to eliminate that and find a common solution and have a common fellowship and work these 12 common steps for other common drunks. The second thing that jumped out at me was, you know, for us, we found there's no middle of the road solution. And that's all I'd ever worked was a middle of the road solution. I'm going to stay safe in my little channel of neutrality here. And I'm not going to be with the big book thumpers, and I'm not going to go too far off the plank by not going to meetings. I'm going to stay in my own self-defined zone of sobriety, and I will determine and define what that is. And I didn't know I was killing myself by doing that. You know, by getting in the middle of the herd. So she encouraged me to do that. She said to me after she heard my story of what it was like in the first 12 years, she said, you know, it sounds to me like you joined the club, you just never got the tattoo. So we set about getting the tattoo, and I went and I did a four-column inventory out of the big book, which I'd never done. And this time that inventory had that very important column on page 67 of the big book that talks about, you know, where was I selfish? Where was I self-seeking? What was my part in these resentments? You know, we're not going to do the blame game anymore. We're not going to put it all on your parents and your divorce and the sexual abuse. We're not going to put it on men. We're not going to put it on your mother's death. It's all going to be now... what was your part in your life and what has happened to you? And it was really a revelation that I hated because I couldn't run anymore. And that's the benefit of a tough sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous, is that they will always take you to our program. They'll always take you to our steps. You know, I believe today that I don't really sponsor as much as I take them to where our program is, which is the 12 steps and the 12 traditions. So anyway... I now was on the ninth step, and I had to now this time go make honest, direct amends to people. And that was a completely new experience, a completely different experience, because I had to now sit in front of someone. She didn't allow me to do phone amends or letter amends. I had to make an appointment. I had to meet with the people. I had to own my part, and then I had to ask what I could do to make it right. And I didn't like doing that. I don't want to do that. I still do it, and I don't like doing it. And I'm here to tell you, if you're new, that you don't have to mean it, you don't have to be ready, you don't even have to be sincere, but you have to do it. You know, Clancy says that the action doesn't care why you take it, but you have to take it. If you want what we have, you have to take it. So I did, and I followed her direction, and I made these direct amends. And I wanted, when I made those last amends, I wanted money, property, and prestige out of having worked the steps. I wanted that as my reward. And it didn't happen 10 years ago, and it hasn't happened yet. But what did happen was when I came home from having made those last amends, is the phone began to ring. And when the phone rang, it was usually like a secretary or somebody who runs a detox or whatever, and they would say, you know, you want to come share your experience, strength, and hope at our meeting. And I would say, sure, because I was taught to not say no to an AA request. And so I started doing H&I work, and I went to my first detox, and I told my story, and you know, it was a stupid story because it had, you know, little. I thought they're going to drink or shoot drugs because, you know, I have no story here. I know I have no program. I've done it wrong all these years, but I did it anyway, and I showed up. And when I told my story, this guy came up to me, and he was torn up and black and blue and missing teeth and, you know, track marks and the whole thing. And he said to me, "Thank you for sharing your experience, strength, and hope. I too thought that I graduated from Alcoholics Anonymous, but I drank. I drank 10 years ago, and I can't get back. And that's why I'm here. I spent the night last night on the sidewalk, and I can't get back." And I related to everything that you said. And so that taught me a lesson that my service work in Alcoholics Anonymous is not my business. That's the third step. Is that it's not my business how I carry the message or what I do or how important it is. If you have a commitment in Alcoholics Anonymous, whether you pick up cigarette butts like I do on Wednesday nights, or whether you're speaking, or whether you're running this conference, whatever you're doing, however big and small, it doesn't matter anymore because God's in charge of that. And that may be the day, the day that you show up and you're setting up chairs, that may be the very night that a newcomer walks in the room and they need to see you do that. If you're speaking in Podunk, wherever, and there's five people, that there may be one person in that room that needs to hear your message. So it's no longer my business what I think of my service commitment or how big or how small it is. What makes a difference and what is important is that I show up. Because I'll be changed, and somebody in the room will probably be changed just by me doing the smallest thing in Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to talk a little bit about what it's like today, because some remarkable things have happened. When I went through our big book with my sponsor, I didn't know what was here, and I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous, and that was not my plan. I had not planned to do that. And I got in the middle of AA, and I got, you know, a strong sponsor, and I began to work the steps, and I began to show up, and it was just remarkable. At that time, Steve, my husband, got Glenn Loyster as a sponsor. He's in the desert, and I think he's got 44 years now. And Glenn really changed our lives. I mean, he is, I think, still, in at least in my experience, one of the probably the best example of Alcoholics Anonymous that I've ever seen. He's in the middle of it, and he just was an attraction. And so he's sponsored by Johnny Harris. We began to come down to Southern California to see Clancy speak and Johnny speak, and we would pile in Glenn's van, and we would, you know, tear down I-5 and come to these conferences. And it was just a remarkable experience of fun. It's like he really introduced us to what Alcoholics Anonymous really is and what is here. You know, if you're either new or you have time, I would love to say that you graduate from AA and that you don't have to take these steps anymore, that you don't have to read the big book. I want to tell you that when I began to go through the book and I read the description of the alcoholic, both in chapter 5 and chapter 6, I noticed eventually that when it talks about, you know, that I read it this morning, you know, we want to run the show, we want to arrange the lights and the scenery, I want to tell you that I noticed that there's no statute of limitations on the description of the alcoholic. I wanted to say that this is true except and until you find him in AA, except and until you have 25 years of sobriety, except and until you sponsor 10,000 people. It will become untrue, you know, when you speak at the podium 9,000 times a year or whatever, and you become an AA star, you know, whatever your thing is, you know, whatever you're looking for, whatever. I don't want the description of the alcoholic to be constant, but unfortunately, in the big book, there's no statute of limitations. There's no condition put on that. It doesn't say that it ends when I find him. It doesn't say that this goes away when I have 25 years. As a matter of fact, it doesn't even say that I have to be drunk in order to have that behavior. In order for my alcoholism to ruin my life and lead me to my next drink, it doesn't even say that I have to be drunk. So, as a result of that, if that's the case, then I apparently have to work this thing on a daily basis, and it's conditioned on my spiritual state. And if that's the case, then I need to continue to make direct amends. And one of the things that I do every day is I call my sponsor, Millie. And as a result of that, you know, recently it was like I called her every day and this thing came out of my mouth and it said, I think I need to go back and I need to redo those half measures amends that I did when I was new. You know, those amends that were half measures or letters amends or amends that were really blaming them. I think I need to go do that. And she said, I agree. And I went about making a list, you know, on our eighth step. And one of the people that I owed amends to were my ex-in-laws. And when I left my husband, my first husband, when I was 30, I got sober and divorced in the same year. And I left him when I was 30 and got sober that same year. And when that happened, I left that family in the way that I leave everything. I simply turn my back and I cut and I run. And I don't, you know, it's like, I'm done with you, you're fired, it's over with. Well, you know, my in-laws were very, very close to me. And it was like I was the daughter they never had. And so, you know, we were very close, we were a family, you know, and then one day I was gone because I didn't want to be part of that any longer. So I believed that I needed to make direct amends to them. And I, the very week that I decided I need to make direct amends is that I was asked to speak at a conference in Aspen. And they happened to be a four-hour drive from Aspen in Colorado. So the flight was planned, and that was paid for, and I just needed to rent a car and go make these direct amends. And I did that. I got on the plane. I went out, you know, 2 days early, and I made these direct amends to them. And it worked out terrific. I hadn't seen them in 23 years, and it was like we had just, you know, seen each other last week. It was a remarkable experience. And as a result of that, you know, one thing that was going on in my life prior to making these amends was that if you're anything like me, you probably have pretty pretty sizable amends or pretty sizable resentments on AA campus. And I had these resentments on AA campus in a couple groups that I go to that I could not get rid of. It's like I threw all the AA that I knew of at these resentments. I prayed for them, and in some cases I made direct amends. You know, I tried to think good thoughts. I tried to do things for them, and I just could not get rid of this, you know, these four or five people on AA campus that I resented, and I couldn't figure out why. And what I want to tell you is that when you make direct amends over here, when you take the action of Alcoholics Anonymous over here, it's, again, not your business what God does in fixing this over here. And so as I made those amends to my in-laws, which I had put off, you know, for 23 years, these resentments over here began somehow to be neutralized. It was like what happens on the page, on pages 84 and 85 of the big book, is that when I do these steps, you know, at the end of step 10, what I get, you know, on the page, on the top of page 85 is this place of neutrality. Now, the book talks about it in regard to alcohol, that I'm neutral toward alcohol. But my experience in taking the black parts of the big book is that it happens toward everything else as well. Through all the human power I knew at these resentments, and nothing could take it away until I cleaned up my side of the street and my wreckage began to and did these amends over here. This over here is subsiding and going away. And I can now walk on AA campus, wherever they're at, you know, wherever they happen to be, and not be owned and possessed by those resentments. And those resentments have nothing to do with them. They're all on my side of the street. And I think it has to do with just the wreckage that never, ever gets cleaned up or that I can excuse. I could have easily done a phone amends. I could have easily done a letter amends with these people. I could possibly even have stayed sober the rest of my life not having made amends because, you know, I harmed them by leaving without saying goodbye, but I could have easily excused myself. But I have a sponsor who doesn't allow that, and she's serious about wanting more for me than I want for myself. So as a result of that, it's just a remarkable journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you take the black parts of the big book, it's there, and I didn't realize how much was here until I began to do that. I need to read one quick thing from the big book, and I always read this when I speak anywhere, and it's on page 100 of the book. And I always read it because that first sponsor of mine called this the hope paragraph, and I always end by by reading this. And she said, whenever you're having a difficult time, read this paragraph, and it'll change your life. And it has changed my life many, many times. It's from the chapter Working with Others. And it says this, both you and the new man must walk day by day in the path of spiritual progress. If you persist, remarkable things will happen. When we look back, we realize that the things which came to us when we put ourselves in God's hands were better than anything we could have planned. Follow the dictates of a higher power, and you will presently live in a new and wonderful world, no matter what your present circumstances. Thanks.